Marbury v. Madison is the single most important Supreme Court case in all of history, I would argue. It's not a First Amendment case, but the reason I teach it is because it gave the Supreme Court power, and it gave it the power of judicial review. Let me explain. That fine-looking gentleman there is William Marbury. William Marbury was a Federalist. He, like John Adams, believed in a strong federal government, and unlike Thomas Jefferson, who believed in strong states' governments. William Marbury wanted to be a judge. So as one of the very last acts that John Adams did as he was leaving office and Jefferson was coming into office, John Adams gave William Marbury a judicial commission, basically a piece of paper saying, you get to be a judge. So he writes it out, but he doesn't get to deliver all of them. Of course, back in 1800, you didn't really have Federal Express or fax machines. All he had was horses. And a bunch of these judicial commissions didn't get delivered. So John Adams moves out. Thomas Jefferson moves in. And Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State, James Madison, which is where we get the Madison part of Marbury versus Madison, asks Jefferson, hey, I see that these judicial commissions are here. Should I deliver them? And Jefferson says, no. I don't want to put my political enemies into the judiciary. So the Jeffersons didn't bother to deliver William Marbury his commission, so Marbury couldn't be a judge. Marbury is understandably peeved about this. So he says to the Supreme Court, hey, Supreme Court, I want you to order Thomas Jefferson to give me my commission so that I get a job. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and the case becomes Marbury versus Madison. Now, a little bit more background. Thomas Jefferson and Chief Justice John Marshall. John Marshall's a big name. It's an important guy in the Supreme Court's history, the third Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But they were second cousins, and they hated each other. I mean, really disliked each other a lot. So John Marshall is thinking, okay, how can I make the Supreme Court more powerful while still embarrassing my cousin? Okay? Because frankly, the Supreme Court was not a very powerful body of government at that time. Congress was important, and the presidency was important, but the Supreme Court was just this little tiny organization, and everybody was bored on it. In fact, the first couple chief justices left the job because they were so bored. Marshall says, okay, I've got an opportunity here. I'm going to take it. So he says to Marbury, you know, Marbury, you're a good guy. By the way, they're both Federalists. I agree with you. You should have gotten your judicial commission, and Thomas Jefferson was naughty for not giving it to you. But you have asked us to use a part of the Judicial Act of 1789 to ask Jefferson to give you that writ, or to ask Jefferson to give you that commission. And frankly, that law doesn't work with the Constitution. It's unconstitutional. So even though you're entitled to your commission, and Jefferson was naughty for not having given it to you, the Supreme Court can't help you either. Okay? So bottom line is, and frankly, in the law, it's kind of unfortunate. We don't really care who wins and loses these cases. Marbury loses, and then he slips out of history. We don't really know what happens to William Marbury. But the Supreme Court won, because the Supreme Court got the power of judicial review. Judicial review is the power to declare laws unconstitutional. I'll say that again. Judicial review is the power to declare laws unconstitutional. And it gave the court cojones, basically. The court is now a co-equal member of the pyramid of government. It's Congress, presidency, Supreme Court, all on equal footing. So it's a really important case, even though it really isn't a First Amendment case. All right, let's turn to the Civil War amendments. Of course, war between the states, 1861 to 1865. Abolishing of slavery, some other rights, but for our purposes, the 14th Amendment was passed, and that was passed essentially to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves. It says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So there are three elements to it: privileges and immunities, due process, and equal protection. Why we care about it for this class is a concept called the incorporation doctrine. Incorporation doctrine applies the First Amendment and a bunch of other amendments to the states. Okay, I'll say that again. The incorporation doctrine uses the 14th Amendment to apply the First Amendment to the states. And it did that in a case called Gitlow, which we'll get to in a few minutes. The Supreme Court, at the very end of its term, has now decided the Second Amendment is incorporated. It's kind of a big deal. It was a big news deal, even though it's not a First Amendment case. The Second Amendment now can be applied to the states. So, in other words, for purposes of our class, the First Amendment reads, Congress shall make no law. The incorporation doctrine makes it read as though it should say, California shall make no law, the city of Fullerton shall make no law, the county of Orange shall make no law. It applies the First Amendment to all levels of government, a very important concept, and we'll come back to it. John Stuart Mill is another critical, frankly, old dead white guy, but he expanded the notion of the marketplace of ideas. All right? His writings on liberty were really critical to how we understand marketplace of ideas and the notion of freedom of expression. Mill said freedom of expression is important because of a couple of different reasons. First of all, standard marketplace of ideas theory, we need to permit everybody to hear. If we don't permit all ideas to be heard, we're never going to know what truth really is. And there may be a particle of truth even in a wrong opinion. You've said this to your friends before. You know, I agree with part of what you're saying, but not the other part. And the public needs to be able to defend the truth. They've got to know that it is the truth, not prejudice. And again, no matter how much we all like and agree with a concept, we really need to be able to defend it. Okay, so Mill makes a very powerful argument for protecting freedom of expression. All right. Sedition. Remember we talked about sedition? We talked about sedition as criticism of the government. So if you say, fill-in-the-blank political person sucks, you are engaging in sedition. Okay, so if I say, you know, Obama sucks, or Bush sucks, or Biden sucks, or Schwarzenegger sucks, that's sedition. Okay? And around wartime, the country gets really skittish about criticism of the government. So we've got World War I now, and we've got two new acts that attempt to shut down discussion or debate that would be critical of the American war effort. The Espionage Act and the Sedition Act prohibited expression that might hurt that effort. The Espionage Act made it a crime to help wartime enemies, and the Sedition Act made it a crime to express opinion that contradicted that of the government. We're going to see this applied in draft cases. A $10,000 fine in 1917 money, you could buy, again, entire cities with that, and 20 years prison for interfering with troop recruitment or speaking against the government. Kind of a dangerous, it's a big law. It's kind of a scary law. And again, 2,000 people were arrested, about 1,000 were convicted. We care about this law because the earliest Supreme Court interpretations of the First Amendment came out of them. Let's talk about a couple of them. First, however, I want to talk to you a little bit about two important Supreme Court justices. The gentleman with the fine handlebar mustache on the top is Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the gentleman on the bottom is Louis Dembitz Brandeis. They were two justices who were instrumental in the creation of First Amendment jurisprudence. They served back in the early 1900s. Brandeis is very important. We'll see him again in privacy law. He was very concerned about individual privacy law. But Holmes and Brandeis were both instrumental in developing a concept known as clear and present danger, which we'll talk about in a minute. Okay? One of the things Holmes said was the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get accepted in the competition of the market. And Brandeis said, you know, fear of serious injury alone cannot justify oppression of free speech and assembly. Men feared witches and burnt women. It is the function of speech to free men from the bondage of irrational fears. So these guys were really powerful advocates of First Amendment freedom. Let's see a couple of the cases they decided. Let's start out with the Espionage Act and Sedition Case Number 1. It's called Schenck versus United States, 1919. Charles Schenck was the Secretary General of the Socialist Party. And he would go down to places where draftees, men who had been drafted, were standing in lines waiting to get, you know, conscripted, basically. And he would hand out leaflets that said, you don't have to do this, you can be a conscientious objector, we need to get rid of this Conscription Act, the Draft Act, doing this all very peacefully. But he was arrested under the Espionage and Sedition Acts because he was encouraging people not to be drafted. They throw him in jail. Holmes actually upholds his conviction and defines the very first limits on government power to stop speech. And here it is. Holmes writes, the question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. In other words, Holmes is saying, well, you know, we protect speech during peacetime that we might not want to protect during war. And if words cause a clear and present danger, we've got the right to shut them down. Clear and present danger is actually kind of a nice legal test because it's not very hard to understand. Clear, present, danger. Okay? Clear and present danger test is pretty precise. Right? The danger has to be there. It's got to be a danger. It's got to be a clear and obvious danger. And present meaning right now. Okay? So Holmes is saying, essentially, speech that we might protect during some times in our history, we're not going to protect in others. And he gave us an example. Falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. Now, if I shout, if I'm sitting in the back of a crowded theater, and I shout fire, and there's no fire, what's going to happen? People are going to start trampling each other to the doorways. There's going to be a big problem. People are going to get hurt, maybe even killed. And I'm a villain. But if I shout fire in a crowded theater and there is a fire, what am I? I'm a hero. I've saved people. So falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater is an act of clear and present danger. And the government could step in to stop that speech. It's the example that's been used throughout history. But again, remember, it's falsely shouting fire, because if I truthfully shout fire, I'm a hero. All right. Let's talk about poor Mr. Abrams. That's the gentleman there in the red circle. Mr. Abrams and his buddies printed up pamphlets. They were kind of violent pamphlets, actually. They wanted a violent revolution and a strike. But he stood on top of a building in New York, and he started throwing out these pamphlets on the street, where they either landed in, you know, on the ground or maybe in people's, you know, awnings or whatever. He wasn't handing them to people. He was just sort of throwing them out. This is the same year that Schenck gets thrown in jail. And they throw Abrams in jail, too. So Abrams is sitting in jail, and Schenck is sitting in jail. But in this case, Holmes and Brandeis say, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. We dissent. Remember, that means we disagree. We don't see a clear and present danger in the surreptitious publishing of a silly leaflet by an unknown man. They kind of slam on Abrams. They say, well, you know, this guy isn't really making any difference. He's just throwing these pamphlets out. We don't know if they're making any difference. So there's no real clear and present danger here, so why are we sticking the guy in jail? Okay? Now you might think, well, you know, we don't really know whether or not the leaflets that Schenck was handing out made any difference either. But what Holmes and Brandeis have done is they've sort of changed their mind on what creates a clear and present danger in that same year. In the first instance, it was. The second instance, it's not. Okay? Does speech have to have an impact to be forbidden? That's up to you to decide. Some people say, well, you know, if you're basically spitting into the wind, it doesn't make any difference. But then when you actually have an impact, we shut you down. It's sort of a difficult line to walk. All right, so clear and present danger now is starting to develop a little bit here. It's actually got to be a clear and present danger, at least for Holmes and Brandeis to like it. Okay. Promised you a little bit of incorporation doctrine law. Here it is. That fine-looking gentleman there is Benjamin Gitlow. He's a communist, all right, socialist. And he wrote an article called A Left-Wing Manifesto, which essentially, again, is the same concept. It encourages there to be strikes and you know, criticism of the government. And it violates, in this case, a state sedition law. The Alien and Sedition Acts and the Espionage and Sedition Acts are federal laws. But all the states passed sedition laws, too. And Gitlow gets in trouble for violating the New York sedition law. Gitlow says, well, wait a minute here. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. Hello? Here I'm being punished under a state law. I shouldn't be able to be punished under a state law. And the Supreme Court says, yeah, you sit in jail, Gitlow. So he does sit in jail. But you're right. The First Amendment needs to apply to the states. All right? So the First Amendment is the First Amendment to be incorporated. All right? Almost all the Bill of Rights now is incorporated through the states. Again, the Second Amendment just got incorporated. All right? But Holmes and Brandeis would let Gitlow go free because they didn't see any clear and present danger. So again, the reason this case is important is, again, it's another case in the line of clear and present danger. And It establishes the incorporation doctrine, which I promise you you'll need to know. All right. This is one of my all-time favorite First Amendment cases. That lady there is Charlotte Anita Whitney. She's a granny in tennis shoes, but she was a firebrand, make no mistake. She was a member of the Communist Labor Party. She would bring food to their meetings, and she really was a very good speech giver, very talkative, very interesting woman. And the Supreme Court upholds her conviction under the California Criminal Syndicalism Act, which is similar to the New York Act that was upheld in the Gitlow case. Okay? So the court, they throw her in jail, and the court leaves her there. Brandeis says, all right, I don't really like this, but really what we have to be thinking about is the notion that more speech is where we should be going with this whole First Amendment thing. He writes, and I think this is one of the most beautiful passages in all of First Amendment law. He writes, if there be time to expose through discussion the falsehood and fallacies, to avert the evil by the process of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence. I get teary every time I read that. I know I'm a dork, but it's really a pretty powerful statement on the notion that when we've got the time, let's not shut people down. Let's let people speak. Let's educate each other. Let's talk it out instead of restraining people. And the notion here is now starting to develop is free speech we should really suppress only in emergencies. We should presume that freedom of expression is the norm. It's a beautiful case, a beautiful quote. And, you know, my students always ask, well, you know, did she die in jail? No, they left her in there for a while to cool her heels, and then they let her out. All right. Fast forward now to the Second World War. Second World War happens, and the Smith Act follows. The Smith Act is another sedition act, makes it a crime to advocate violent overthrow of government or to belong to a group that does that. First case that comes out under it is the Dennis case. Eugene Dennis is convicted under the Smith Act because he's a communist. He belongs to a group that advocates a violent overthrow of the government. Now, the Supreme Court starts to water down clear and present danger. Okay? Clear and present danger, up until this point, was a really easy test. Clear, present danger. It doesn't take a brain surgeon, right? Now the Supreme Court says, well, now we should consider if the gravity of the evil, discounted by its improbability, justifies such invasion of free speech as is necessary to avoid the danger. In English, the court is saying, well, we're going to move away from clear present danger, which is, you know, unfortunately a really nice test, toward this gravity of the evil test. How evil is it, and how likely is it to occur? I'll say that again. How evil is it, the act, and how likely is it to occur? Okay? So in other words, we're starting to move away from a really speech-protective position in clear and present danger to something more namby-pamby, okay? We now start, however, also the court is starting to see a distinction between teaching and advocacy. And we'll talk about that. That becomes important in just a minute. All right. Another Smith Act case. 6 years later, the Yates case. Another set of communists. Dennis is sitting in jail, but in this case, the court throws out the convictions. This is a really important case. The court says, okay, we're now going to say that you can only use the Smith Act to keep people in jail if there is evidence that the advocacy was of concrete action, or what we would call advocacy to action, not just wah, wah, wah. Okay? So in this case, you actually have a situation where there is teaching, all right, rather than advocacy, all right? Action versus thoughts. Let me give you an example. You guys have all watched the Charlie Brown shows. It's one thing if I go before a class and I say, wah, 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 you know, we should get rid of, you know, the government right now. It's really not a very good government. Maybe we ought to go with Rousseau and have a benevolent dictator. And this democracy thing just isn't working. That's fine. What is not fine, however, is if I come into class and I start screaming at the top of my lungs, okay, we're really going to go and kill people right now. I'm going to drop the F-bomb because, you know, you can blast through the next 15 seconds if you want. Okay, you motherfuckers, I'm really sick of this whole idea of democracy. You all are too stupid to get it, so I'm going to go get some fucking guns and we're going to go and fucking shoot people. You can come back now if you turned it off. In this case, that's not protected anymore because I am advocating violence. It's one thing to teach about concepts or theories of violence. It is another thing to advocate it. Okay? So, clear and present danger today is in the Brandenburg case. The Brandenburg case is a KKK case, the Ku Klux Klan. Clarence Brandenburg, an evil guy, he goes to Ohio and he has a big rally and he says, I want to send people back to Africa, Jews back to Israel. Not a very nice guy. But he's preaching to the choir here. There's no violence. All right? So now what happens is they declare the law unconstitutional, the Supreme Court does. And the current clear and present danger test is imminent lawless action. You've got to be calling for violence right now. Okay? Speech can be prohibited if it is directed at inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce that action. So, clear and present danger moves through clear and present danger, okay, clear present danger, to gravity of the evil, so we do kind of a balancing test, and today it is imminent lawless action out of Brandenburg. The court in this case is saying it is one thing for me to wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah, and it is another thing to come in and start handing you the guns, okay? Once we move from abstract advocacy to action, then the government can step in and say no. Okay? All right. Now, the First Amendment has many different ways it can be interpreted by the courts. And sometimes I think the courts, you know, the justices wake up in the morning and pick a, you know, a way to interpret it based on what side of bed they got up on. Oh, today I got up on the right side, I'll choose X. All right? But that said, there are some that have come out. Balancing tests are really common in the law. We balance the right of people to speak against a potential harm, or the right of one group of people to speak against another group of people to speak. Clear and present danger, frankly, is a balancing test. When we get to chapters 7 and 8, we're going to talk about rights of the accused versus the right to speak. The law is completely full of balancing tests. Okay, so those are important concepts. The preferred position test comes out of a case in which the Supreme Court said in a famous footnote, saying that prejudice directed against discrete and insular minorities may call for more searching judicial inquiry, which is a fancy way of saying the First Amendment is more important than some of the other rights. It is a preferred right. And not just because it comes first in the Bill of Rights. It actually didn't originally come first. It was third. Okay? But it is an important, critical right that we tend to prefer to protect over some other rights. So the First Amendment is in a preferred position. The courts will often talk about a compelling state interest. We're going to talk about that when we get to Chapter 13. A compelling state interest is something that's really critical for the government to take care of. Protecting voting is a compelling state interest. Protecting children is a compelling state interest. Right? The First Amendment usually gets a compelling state interest argument against it. Okay, because in order to abridge free speech, the state really has to have a good reason. A rational relationship is a lower level of proof that we'll spend additional time talking about later on in the semester. Laws that are vague or overbroad are unclear. The Supreme Court really doesn't like laws that are not clear because they believe that people ought to know what they can say or not say. Okay? If a law is vague, that means you don't really know what it protects or what it prohibits. If a law is overbroad, that means it covers too much speech. We will revisit these concepts again and again. So again, vagueness is unclear. Overbreadth is too big, covers too much speech. Now, content-based and content-neutral laws are something we'll come back to over and over again. Content-based laws regulate speech because of what they say, it says. It gets strict scrutiny, which means that it's usually unconstitutional. Let me give you an example. Let's say that Cal State Fullerton decides that there have been too many rowdy student groups on campus, so it bans one particular group. Let's say it bans the College Democrats because they've had too many protests. That's a content-based regulation. They are singling out the College Democrats for activities that they did. If that case went to court, all right, It would get strict scrutiny, which is a very close look, and it would probably be unconstitutional. A content-neutral law, on the other hand, would say all student groups have to be regulated the same. So all student groups can have one protest a month on campus, no matter what they're protesting. That's a content-neutral regulation. It gets ordinary scrutiny, which means there just has to be a good relationship between the law and the regulation, and it is probably constitutional. We will return to this next chapter. It's a very important concept. Okay. Again, I always do a major points of the chapter. And that's chapter 2.